And welcome to another podcast at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and other great local unions like the Madison Firefighters and Teamsters. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. John, I really watched last night with a profound sense of sadness. I really do love being a citizen of the United States of America and consider it an honor to have grown up here in spite of the country's politicians making mistakes in my lifetime. But what I witnessed last night was truly sickening.
Yeah, it was a bizarre, bizarre performance. And what's so weird about it is you see something like that and you realize the extent to which Trump continues to play us. You know, and that's the only way to say it. He went on the night before, did his announcement as regards Afghanistan. It was done from a teleprompter with a very carefully prepared speech, and obviously a desperate attempt to try and dial down some of the controversy that erupted after Charlottesville. You know, it all made sense, and you thought for a second, well, you know, this is really interesting. Maybe he's starting to get it. Maybe he's never going to be what you or I would want as a president. In fact, never even acceptable as a president. But, you know, not overtly trying to tear the country apart. And then there was the announcement, well, he isn't going to pardon Joe Arpaio, the scandal-plagued, criminally convicted sheriff from down in Phoenix, when he goes to the Phoenix rally. And that was seemed to be another signal during the day that he was dialing it down a little bit. And then he gets to Phoenix, and a couple of things that are fascinating about it. First off, clearly he had no prepared speech, right? He wasn't reading from a teleprompter. He had some notes, which were mainly about how the media had treated him. And then he just went, you know, on a bizarre...
Well, let me play. This is him talking about the media. That's a pejorative for some.
Yeah. The failing New York Times, which is like so bad. It's so bad. The Washington Post, which I call a lobbying tool for Amazon, okay? CNN, which is so bad and so pathetic, and their ratings are going down. ABC this morning. They have little George Stephanopoulos talking to Nikki Haley, right? Little George. But for the most part, honestly, these are really, really dishonest people, and they're bad people. And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that. And I don't believe they're going to change, and that's why I do this. If they would change, I would never say it. The only people giving a platform to these hate groups is the media itself and the fake news.
That's when he still had the audience before they started leaving or curling up in a ball on the floor.
Yeah, it was interesting because there was a reporter, I don't know which network he was from, who kept tweeting out pictures from the back of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And there was clearly a lot of space that wasn't filled. And so it made an interesting dynamic. Although, in fairness to Trump, he had a big crowd. I mean, there was...
Well,
number of people there.
Yeah, Loretta drove from Arkansas City, Kansas, 18 hours to be there with her mini patriotic Uncle Sam hat.
And that's the interesting dynamic of, you know, and we never know on this fully, to what extent is it an incoming of Trump backers from a lot of different places versus a local, you know, or an essentially local event. But accepting the reality that he had a decent number of people there, and they were with him at certain early points, but it's clear it started to fray as the speech went on, because it was a incredibly repetitive and incoherent speech, and it also, interestingly enough, it wasn't a serious attempt to do what he appeared to try to be doing, because when he read off his statements, you know, what he had said before, everyone, even the most, you know, intense Trump backer, knows that he got in trouble because of an equating of people who were advocating for racist and fascist ideologies and those who opposed him, basically saying, well, they're, you know, two sides of the same coin, many sides to this. And then coming back a couple days later and suggesting that there are many fine people marching with the fascists and the Nazis and the Confederates. And he didn't, you know, he kind of self-edited his remarks and only highlighted where he was critical of the fascists. And
well, let me play a clip. I think the tenor of this is just, the tone of this is absolutely astounding.
What happened in Charlottesville strikes at the core of America. And tonight, this entire arena stands united in forceful condemnation of the thugs who perpetrate hatred and violence. But the very dishonest media, those people right up there with all the cameras, they don't report the facts. Just like they don't want to report that I spoke out forcefully against hatred, bigotry, and violence, and strongly condemned the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, and the KKK. I said everything. I hit them with neo-Nazi. I hit them with everything. I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi, I got them all in there, let's see. Yeah, KKK, we have KKK. I got them all. So they're having a hard time. So what did they say? Right? It should have been sooner. He's a racist.
That is mocking and joking about something that is just horrifying to people.
Right.
You know, if you listen to the pastor, the African-American pastor who was inside the church the night before that raucous thing, when all the people were out there with their tiki torches, they were frightened to death. They couldn't leave their church. There were children crying and hiding.
Well, and you know, Trump, in his event last night, again tried to suggest that those who were protesting against the Nazis and the fascists, those who were resisting the Nazis and the fascists, were somehow the source of the problem.
Uh-huh.
Even mentioning Antifa and stuff like that, right? And yet, if you listen to those pastors, at least some of the people who were at the church, they say that if there hadn't been folks out there resisting, if there hadn't been, you know, folks who were clearly, you know, trying to surround the church and keep the fascists and the Nazis people away, that they feared for their lives, that they feared they might not have survived. Now, we don't know if that's hyperbole. We don't know, you know, where the line is, because you and I weren't there. But we have to respect people who are on the ground. And so for Trump to, even last night, again, try to equate those who are with the Nazis and those who are against the Nazis, and to try and suggest that those on the left who were, you know, opposing the Nazis were the problem, it's just a rewrite of history, and it goes at odds with what those pastors and others have been saying.
Well, you know, the Washington Post obviously did an interesting story, and some of this is subjective rather than objective when you fact check a president. I understand that. But look, this guy has a very, very bad record when it comes to telling the truth. He's over 1,000, I think, just since he took office.
Well,
over 1,000 things he said.
The better part of 1,000 last night. you know, I mean.
Oh, you get the line of the day, John.
the guy had an opportunity last night with a friendly crowd to have said, you know, people got mad at me when I said on many sides. What did I mean by that? And he could have offered some explanation. We might have liked it. We might have disliked it. But he could have done it. He said. He could have said, people got mad at me when I said many fine people or fine people marched with those folks who were trying to protect those monuments who were, in fact, many of the marchers, fascists, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, segregationists. But he said many fine people were with him. What did I mean by that? He could have explained, again, you and I might be here today criticizing his explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't even try to.
No, he didn't. He also accused his opponents of being anarchists. So I thought this was appropriate.
Was Sheriff Joe convicted for doing his job. That's what. He should have had a jury, but you know what? I'll make a prediction. I think he's going to be just fine, okay? But I won't do it tonight because I don't want to cause any controversy. Is that okay? But Sheriff Joe can feel good.
Former, by the way, the voters of Maricopa County voted Joe Arpaio out of office. Maricopa County is not a liberal county. It is a county that leans a little conservative.
Yeah.
And Joe Arpaio lost in a year that Arizona narrowly went for Donald Trump. The voters rejected Joe Arpaio because he broke the law.
Yeah.
He defied a court order. Yeah. He defied the federal court system.
On something that has been central to his career. So it was, you know, there was no gray area here. It wasn't like, wow, maybe he didn't know what was going on or maybe there was a lack of clarity. No, this was repeated efforts to get him to follow the law, to do, you know, basically what is required of any sheriff in the country. And he wouldn't do it. And he's played this game, a very lawless game, which frankly, if we're honest with ourselves, your comparisons go back to the 1960s when you had, in the early 1960s, when you had a federal government clearly saying that there has to be equal protection, it has to be equal rights, and officials on the ground in a handful of southern states, but very obviously Alabama, Mississippi, to some earlier to some extent in Arkansas, saying no, rejecting.
Well,
the federal law.
What reminds me of Orville Faubus. It reminds me of Roscoe Barnett. It reminds me of George Wallace.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was also the massive resistance folks in Virginia. And, you know, it was this thing of states' rights trumps, to use the inappropriate term, federal law. And the significant thing about the early 1960s was, as bad as things got, you knew that the federal government backed up its laws and backed up its judges, and that's why, as rough as things got, there was some sense of a safety net, of a safety valve on the situation. And federal troops were sent in a number of instances. A lot of protection was laid on the ground, and that way too slowly advanced helped to advance the civil rights bill, Voting Rights Act, things of that nature. Here is Trump going to Arizona saying, you know, this guy was convicted, he's in a lot of legal trouble, and as President of the United States, he's going to be fine. It's going to be okay for him, right? Imagine if John Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson had said at critical stages in 63, 64, 65, that, you know, the sheriffs and the governors and others on the ground in southern states are going to be fine. It's going to be okay. Right? Just think of what might have been unleashed.
Does Donald Trump understand how demographically Arizona and Texas, New Mexico has already flipped, California flipped, Florida is moving in a very different direction? Does he understand long-term this is just absolutely, Georgia is absolutely poison for Republicans and their future?
I don't think he cares at all. If he understands, which I'm not sure he does, I genuinely don't think he cares. And beyond that, though, we should not underestimate that this is a president who has thrown in with Kris Kobach and other folks who are, you know, Kobach is referred to as the king of voter suppression. And that's the guy Trump has in charge of his commission looking at voting issues. And so, on the one side, I really don't think Trump cares about anything very far into the future. On the other side, he has people around him who seem to be very determined to resist the demographic waves of the future making it hard for people to vote.
Let me, of all the things that happened last night, this is one of the more significant, and it didn't happen. You know, by the way, the fact that Ben Carson was there, that was a campaign event paid for by Trump 2020. the fact that Ben Carson was there, other than probably violating the Hatch Act, was one of the most craven things in the world that I've ever seen. Here is what happened after the rally on CNN last night. Don Lemon with James Clapper, who of course was with the Department of National Intelligence.
I don't know when I've listened and watched something like this from a president that I found more disturbing. Having some understanding of the levers of power that are available to a president if he chooses to exercise them, I found this downright scary and disturbing.
Are you questioning his fitness?
Yes, I do. I really question his ability to his fitness to be in this office, and I also am beginning to wonder about his motivation for it. Maybe he is looking for a way out.
Is he a threat to national security, the president?
Well, he certainly could be. Having some understanding of the levers that a president can exercise, I worry about, frankly, the access to nuclear codes. If he, in a fit of pique, he decides to do something about Kim Jong-un, there's actually very little to stop him.
I'm going to get your reaction to that next when we come back. It's SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. We're talking with John Nichols.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
We're back with John Nichols at SlysOffice.com with many great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, SNR Remodeling, AMS, and St. Vincent de Paul, as well as the Axley Law Firm. All right, John Nichols, I played the clip of the former leader of the National Intelligence, James Clapper. I read through his resume today. He grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Just looking at his resume, I wouldn't put him probably in someone that probably shares a lot of views with Bert Zipper. By the way, I share a lot of views with Bert Zipper, but I'm just guessing that Clapper's not a Sandinista.
You could put it another way. I could give you a bill of particulars of things that I'm very critical of James Clapper.
Correct.
I find plenty of things I disagree with the guy on. And I think that what he is saying about this is a very sincere expression of concern by someone who has been very much at the center of efforts to protect the United States. Historically, the oath of office is an interesting one, because when you swear your oath at taking on any number of responsibilities, you swear to protect the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, right? Or different variations on that language. For the most part, overwhelmingly, we think of it as foreign threats from afar that might steer this country into a very horrible, very dangerous place. And we don't think about domestic players who are so erratic, so irrational, that they themselves become dangerous. I really didn't like Dick Cheney, and I really didn't like George W. Bush when they were in office. I truly, passionately disagreed with them. I thought they should be impeached and removed from office when they were there. And yet, I don't think that I ever thought that even Cheney, at his worst, might just lose control. I mean, I thought Cheney was calculating and dishonest and a very bad player. But I didn't think he would, just go off the rails and as Clapper suggests, bring the United States and the world to the brink of nuclear war. With Trump, I don't know that that's the case with Trump, but I know that people like Clapper, who think about this a lot more than I do probably, are taking it very, very seriously.
All right, let's get to President Trump's speech in Virginia the other night at an Army base, where he talked about our continuation of military efforts in Afghanistan.
Shortly after my inauguration, I directed Secretary of Defense Mattis and my national security team to undertake a comprehensive review of all strategic options in Afghanistan and South Asia. My original instinct was to pull out, and historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're president of the United States. We are not nation building again. We are killing terrorists. The next pillar of our new strategy is to change the approach and how to deal with Pakistan. We can no longer be silent about Pakistan's safe havens for terrorist organizations, the Taliban, and other groups that pose a threat to the region and beyond. It is time for Pakistan to demonstrate its commitment to civilization, order, and to peace.
Does he understand that there are a lot of Afghan refugees in Pakistan? Pakistan's got quite a card to play. It's interesting. He's saying they're not a civilized country. That may have been the most damaging part of that speech the other night.
Well, okay. Here's a couple things. There's a lot of damaging parts of that speech.
Right.
The most damaging part of that speech is that for a brief moment, Donald Trump made me respect his instincts. Because his instincts are right. We really do need to accept that our potential for a military solution that is satisfying or even functional.
If you could speak up just a little.
Our potential for a military solution that is satisfying or even functional in Afghanistan is well exhausted. You know, we've been there for 16 years, and it just hasn't worked. And so clearly diplomacy is the answer. He recognized that as a candidate. Now he's abandoning it because he has surrounded himself with generals who, despite their good press, tend to be guys who really do look for military solutions rather than diplomatic solutions, or at least are insufficiently committed to the diplomacy that needs to be done.
We don't have a State Department.
No, they're dialing down the State Department. Tillerson will go down in history as the worst Secretary of State in history.
I don't even think he matters.
Well, that's the point. That's what makes him the worst, Sly. Because historically, a Secretary of State was someone who was a counterbalance to the generals and said, no, look, I'm talking to my staff, I'm talking to these people, we've got ideas here for how to do this. And the generals, smart generals, would often say, well, that's a good point, let's combine that, let's send our military signals, but let's also try and make the diplomacy work. Trump has dialed diplomacy down to such an extent that we then get to the second part of your equation. He said things in that speech that the State Department, under Republican and Democratic presidents, has counseled and carefully avoided saying for a reason. And that is that the geopolitics of Southern Asia are so delicate and so complex that if you trip the wrong trigger, so to speak, you can make everything go bad. And I dare say that while Americans don't necessarily get a sufficient news coverage from that region, no one in their right mind would suggest that Afghanistan matters more than a functional relationship between Pakistan and India.
Let me play something. This is from earlier this year.
A glimpse into Donald Trump's diplomacy Wednesday when Pakistan's government published apparent excerpts from a phone call between Trump and Prime Minister Mohammad Nawaz Sharif. Sharif had reached out to congratulate the president-elect. Now, governments typically release summaries of conversations with foreign leaders, but this release had what appears to be quotes from Trump. Trump apparently told Sharif You are a terrific guy. You are doing amazing work, which is visible in every way. Trump also called Pakistan a fantastic country, fantastic place of fantastic people. And he said, Pakistanis are amazing, and all Pakistanis I have known are exceptional people.
Now, Hillary Clinton's got to be just cringing. She spent a very long time getting to know the world.
She actually, again, this is the tragedy of it. The woman who studies up, does all the work, and then she has sort of an incompetent guy who takes the job, right? And in the case of Trump. And here's the interesting thing. This is where it gets, you bring up a really significant point, because Russ Feingold, I believe, and I hope I'm right in recalling this, Russ Feingold once told me, and I think maybe told you, about a time when he traveled in some of these countries with Hillary Clinton and with John McCain and with some other folks. And what was fascinating about it is that in Feingold's experience, and again, I hope I'm not trying to speak out of turn for him, when Hillary Clinton got off the plane, the powerful people on the ground walked right past, you know, all the other folks and went straight to her. And they didn't go to her, you know, in some show or some fake thing. They respected that she was the person who was arriving with knowledge and with, you know, the right connections to the Obama administration to talk about what was happening. And now we have a president who is so opposite that, so antithetical to that, that it is hard to imagine that anyone would rush to Donald Trump and say, boy, I really, you know, you're the guy. You know what's going on.
Let me play a clip of Naira Hack. She was in the State Department during the Obama administration. Here's what she said about Trump's speech.
General is the one with Russia. The Russians have a long history in Afghanistan since the 1980s, which is going back to U.S. involvement with the CIA. The Russians are supporting the Taliban in the north. A lot of the U.S. losses are now because the Russians have come back in and are starting to play territorial games. That this regional diplomacy and regional strategy has to be something that Donald Trump considers. Unfortunately, he's gutted the State Department. He has completely disempowered Tillerson, anybody in the Foreign Service, and anybody with history and expertise in the region and the politics and dynamics. So to say that Afghanistan is going to be a long-term diplomatic political play, when frankly President Trump is considered poison around the world at the G20 and any of the diplomatic tables, not sure how he's going to meet any of these goals of bringing countries together to support Afghanistan.
All right. That's scary, isn't it?
Well, it's terrifying. And again, it goes to the reality that Rex Tillerson is managing the downsizing of the U.S. State Department. And Trump has clearly signaled that he's interested in listening to generals, not to the State Department. Tillerson isn't even a player, as best we can tell, and the people who should be players have been shunted aside. I was talking the other day to an outgoing ambassador, one of Obama's ambassadors, who was so well respected in another country that the Trump people even talked a little about keeping the guy on, or at least the Tillerson people talked a little bit about keeping the guy on. And the guy said, there's no way I could stay, because what's happening in the State Department is that at this point they're sort of erecting barriers to sensible and rational, you know, mainstream ideas kind of filtering up through the process and being heard at the White House. And it's just they're shutting it off. And this is a terrible thought. I mean, imagine this, that we actually know how to deal with a lot of the problems in the world, and yet that knowledge is being shunted aside by our Secretary of State.
Let's not forget, as we wrap this up today and talking about Afghanistan, the mistakes that George W. Bush, by getting into the misadventure in Iraq and how that affected Afghanistan, the number of mistakes that he made. But let's not forget that Barack Obama made a terrible mistake as well. I mentioned this to you the other day when we weren't on the air, but Richard Holbrooke, who I know you don't always agree with. He, of course, he passed away in 2010, but of a heart attack. This is literally months before he died. He was on NPR, and of course, there is now a movie about him. He did kind of a diary during the time period that he served as a special envoy for the Obama administration in Afghanistan, and he obviously didn't agree with sending more troops, but here he is on NPR. I believe this is from November of 2010.
About negotiations, as you were the man who brokered the peace agreement known as the Dayton Accords that ended the war in Bosnia back in the 90s. Are there any lessons that can be applied to the situation in Afghanistan, or is it just too different?
Well, I thought about that a lot, and of course I also was the junior member of the negotiating team with the North Vietnamese in Paris way back in 1968, and I've done a lot of other negotiations. Each negotiation has its own dynamic, Renee, and this one is unique. It's not going to end at a place like Dayton, Ohio, where you get all the combatants behind a high barbed wire fence and don't let them out until you have an agreement, for the simplest of reasons. There's no single address for the people we're fighting. There's no Ho Chi Minh, as there was in Vietnam. There's no Slobodan Milosevic, as there was in the Balkans. You have a wide variety of people grouped under a loosely jihadist, loosely anti-American banner. Perhaps the best way to do it is to look for ways to separate and fragment it piece by piece. And above all, Renee, I want to emphasize this point. Whatever happens in Afghanistan in terms of reconciliation has to be Afghan-led.
Do you disagree with anything you said?
No, I mean, obviously, the guy, again, as you say, there are points where I haven't always agreed with him, or didn't always agree with him, but he's speaking from a great deal of experience. And, Sly, this is the point that we've gotten to, and it could be the most important thing that we say today, and that is that we've moved beyond the point of debates among informed and intelligent and experienced people about different strategies. Now we are at a point where informed and intelligent and experienced people, no matter what their specific tactic or strategy, are on one side, and the Trump administration is on the other side.
No one wants the images, and they are profound in all of our psyche, of helicopters having to be pushed off aircraft carriers to make room for people fleeing Saigon. Sure. And the helicopters landing on the pad and people scrambling and beating each other to get out of a country that's fallen. Richard Nixon had obviously promised the South Vietnamese government that he would protect them from the North. Watergate happened. Obviously, that did not happen.
Not kept.
What's that?
Promises were made. They were not kept.
Not kept. No American president wants to see that in Afghanistan after 16 years. So, and I don't think that there's a simple solution, but is sending more troops that are unspecified going to, in the long run, make Afghanistan stable?
You know, here's an answer to that question, and it shouldn't come from me or from you. If Donald Trump wants to know the answer, he should just call his buddy Vladimir Putin. Because Putin well remembers when a country tried to stabilize Afghanistan over a long period of time with a lot of troops. What happened?
I remember that vision as well, of all those vehicles leaving Afghanistan.
It was a massive failure. And the interesting thing is that massive failure then fed more crises, and it just kept evolving. And then the United States tried, and it didn't work.
What is Afghanistan called? The graveyard for invading armies?
Graveyard for empires, I think. And
that was
and
close.
The British had some experience there as well. And all I'm saying is none of that detracts from the courageous service of Americans in Afghanistan. There are people who tried really hard and, in fact, who accomplished some significant things.
That's right. And John Kelly lost his son there, so obviously.
Right. And we should honor that. You know, and even if you agreed or disagreed, whatever your stance on it is, people tried really, really hard. Good people tried really hard. And if we honor their service, then maybe we ought to recognize that if it was possible to get it right, they would have done so.
John Nichols.
They didn't fail, that they were given a task that was undoable.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation, thanks for coming to Sly's office, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.